I'll be all right.
Senate State Affairs is called to order. It's 9:03, and the date is the 22nd. Present for the record are Senators Bundy, Green, and McGuire. We do have a quorum to conduct business, and we have five items on the agenda today. We're going to shift the schedule and put our Speaker of the House up to the top. He has a scheduling conflict. So HB 117, proclamation calling a special session. Speaker Harris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And for the record, I am John Harris, representative from District 12. And before you is House Bill 117, and it's very basic. This all stems from the frustrations I think a lot of us had last year in anticipating in our work schedules and everything else about a call for a special session. And what this bill does is it changes the date and statute, or the time and statute, from 15 days to 30 days. It does not disable the governor from calling us into special session immediately in emergencies or any of those other types of events that may be necessary to have the legislature in session. But it does say if you're going to just have a normal special session for some event, that you give people a time to kind of adjust their lives to do that. Many people have vacations, they have work schedules, they have other things they're trying to do as ordinary citizens outside of the legislature, and just a little longer period of time to try to adjust their schedule. That's basically all the bill does.
Speaker Harris, did you give any thought to, and probably did, and it raised constitutional issues, but to limiting the reasons by which a special session could be called?
No.
Okay.
We didn't limit those.
Because I know a lot of folks in my district, boy, did I hear an earful this summer about the number of special sessions, the cost of them, whether they were being called for appropriate reasons. If you don't get your way, I'm going to call you back type thing. So I just wonder if you thought about it.
Madam Chair, we've heard all those as well. Did not want to get into those constitutional issues, and this is sort of pretty basic. But it's the present governor has said she didn't have a problem with this, and she wants to work with us anyway, and that's, you know. So my guess is it probably wouldn't be as big an issue under this situation. But again, a declaration of disaster or other things like that, the governor could call us in immediately.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Questions from the committee? Senator French has joined us. Anybody here in the audience to testify? Anybody online? Okay, hearing none, public testimony is closed. So we do have CS for House Bill number 117 before us. Can I have a motion? Senator Green.
Madam Chairman, I move House Bill 117 from committee with individual recommendations. And so it's a zero fiscal note.
Yep. Okay, any objection? Hearing none, so moved.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Okay, so next we're going to go to Senate Bill number 92, Ignition Interlock Devices. Senator French, do you want a minute? You want to take an at ease?
I'm ready, Madam Chair.
Okay, he's ready.
This is the committee. It's in the mood.
Senator Stevens has joined us.
Good morning.
Okay, so he has a CS. We're on Senate Bill number 92, Ignition Interlock Devices. And hearing it, I think we're on our, what are we on, our second hearing?
That's right.
Third. It's been a long time. Senator Green remembers. Okay, so would you like a motion to adopt this? Senator Green, I'm going to make a motion to adopt the CS.
Well, I move that we consider the CS /M before us today for discussion.
Okay, any objection to that motion? Okay, so we have /M before us. Senator French.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. The CS essentially adopts the issue, or addresses the issue that we discussed last time, which is how to deal with the rural parts of the state where it's just, you know, impractical to force an eye or implement an ignition interlock device, and more importantly, how to deal with folks. And let me just give you an example that we talked about with Mr. Bannett quite a bit, and it will illustrate what we were trying to get at. And we'll use the village of Tyonic and the city of Anchorage as an example.
Okay.
What do you do with someone who lives in Tyonic, comes to Anchorage, and gets a DWI, and then goes back to Tyonic?
Right.
Or what do you do with a person from Anchorage who's out in the bush, for example, in Tyonic, and gets a DWI, and comes back to Anchorage? How do you deal with those issues? And we decided that the real point was to, in working with the Department of Public Safety and the Department of Motor Vehicles, we came up with an idea that roughly parallels the requirement for motor vehicle insurance. There's parts of the state, most parts of the state, you have to have motor vehicle insurance when you operate a car. There's some places where we don't require it. And in order to not reinvent the wheel with respect to ignition interlock devices, we adopted the same division. So it's a geographic division. If you get a second or subsequent DWI, and if you want to operate a motor vehicle in 95% of the state, you have to have an ignition interlock.
Okay.
No matter where you get the DWI, no matter where you're from, no matter who you are, if you're driving amongst the vast majority of the people in the state, you have to have the ignition interlock. Now, if you're out in a remote place that doesn't have an ability to calibrate them, install them, and so forth, fine. Just like insurance, you don't have to have the ignition interlock there.
Good.
But there's no sort of there's no differentiation based on persons. It's strictly geography. And that's embedded in the bill in a couple of places. First off, in and probably most clearly, page 2, mm-hmm. lines 18, 19, 20.
Yep.
That sort of sets out the basic idea. And then there's a new subsection, which is on page 6 and 7, bottom of page 6, top of page 7. And it's probably clearest on the top of page 7. It says, notwithstanding all the requirements that you must have the ignition interlock, the court will waive it. When the will waive essentially a prosecution or a requirement when you operate the motor vehicle in a community included on the list that parallels the insurance list. And I believe you have a copy of those communities in a separate handout that we prepared. It's this one. And you can go down the list and see these are the places, the tiny communities, where the requirement will be waived. Everywhere else, you have to have an ignition interlock. So that's how we address that issue. Madam Chairman, I'd be happy to take questions.
Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is so convoluted, but let's see if I understand if what I'm questioning is that rental cars, say I have a DWR. Let's say you have a DWR.
I'll take the heat. Okay. It's my bill.
And a gift card.
And you go someplace where you rent a car. So we expect rental cars to have these devices. What happens in that case? Would rental companies even rent to someone who has that issue to deal with, or would they even know about it?
There's a mark on a driver's license that would indicate that you are a person required to use an ignition interlock. Whether the rental car company would pick up on it or not, I don't know. But the onus is on the individual, and the owner, the person, would be breaking the law if he or she drove a rental car without an ignition interlock. Mm-hmm. So that's the short answer.
Probably an education, issue too, that, getting a copy of the bill and some statement about what should happen and so forth might be helpful. Senator Bundy.
Thank you. Senator French, the list of places where you don't have to have insurance is pretty substantial. At one time, I thought that it was based on whether there was state highways there or not, state-funded roads. But I know there's Iliamna, which has a substantial amount of road, is included in the list. So apparently that's not the deciding factor. Do you know how they come to the conclusion that a village or community should be on the list?
Dwayne Bannock's on the line.
Why don't we turn to Dwayne Bannock? I could hazard a guess, but he can probably give you a good answer.
Thank you.
Mr. Bannock, did you hear Senator Bundy's question, and would you be willing to answer that?
Yes, ma'am. Good morning. I'm Dwayne Bannock with the Alaska Division of Motor Vehicles, and I believe the question was, how did the list get created, mm-hmm. or what was the criteria for it?
That's correct.
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, Alaska Statute 2810 governs motor vehicles and registration. 2810.010 gives us a list of vehicles that are required for registration purposes. Senator French had also testified that these vehicles are also excluded from automobile insurance. It's found at 2810.011, and it says if a vehicle is being driven or moved on a highway, a parking place that is not connected to the land highway or vehicular way, and there is an average daily traffic volume greater than 499. So in an area, that to just take that and put it in a little more simple language, to an area that is off of the highway system and has a traffic count of less than 499, then not only is registration exempted, but so is the mandatory insurance.
Senator Bundy, yes.
Thank you. I can understand that in a place like Chalkeetic, but how often do you take those traffic counts? Because Iliamna has an incredible amount of traffic. Kotzebue is a growing community with lots of traffic. Fort Yukon has lots of traffic.
Sir, we rely on data from the Department of Transportation as to what their schedule is for updating that. Regretfully, sir, forgive me, I don't know the answer to that.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I think Senator Bundy makes a good point. You kind of look through both pages, and the obvious ones are here, but those three do seem to stand out. So maybe that's something we want to work on at a later point. But I think, Senator French, you've certainly worked with the committee to strike a balance here. We know what we're getting at. And then I think now it's just a point of education in terms of the requirement for the interlock. There'll always be people that'll try to skirt the law, and some people, frankly, that just don't care, right? They've had their license even taken away from them, and they still drive so terribly. So any further testimony? Dwayne, did you want to add anything else to your testimony today?
No, thank you, madam, other than the fact that we've certainly enjoyed working with Senator French's office, and I think this bill is coming off a long ways, and we believe that it's a pretty darn good bill.
Great. Anybody else here in the audience to testify for the third time on Senate Bill number 92, or anyone online that I've overlooked? Okay, so hearing and seeing none, public testimony is closed, and that brings the CS back before us for committee discussion and debate. Discussion? Senator Bundy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to my thanks to Senator French for, and I think there was some agreement and discussion in committee that if we obviously we want to protect the innocent driver from the habitual drunk, and people in rural Alaska should have the same kind of protection that people in urban Alaska would get from this. It was pointed out there are, I think, some there needs to be some adjustment to this list, but that's beyond the scope of the bill, and I appreciate what seems to be a workable answer.
Okay, further discussion? Senator Stevens.
Oh, Mr. Chairman, I agree. I think just the fact that we've sort of gone beyond just the location now to a statewide look at things, and I think that's really appropriate. So, Madam Chair, I move that we move out CS for Senate Bill number 92 with the attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
Okay, is there an objection to that motion? Hearing and seeing none, Senate Bill number 92, as amended, individual recommendations, has moved. Okay, so we're still signing committee reports. They'll just keep coming down. Let's just keep moving. Senate Bill number 115 by me, Marit. So when we last left off, we had our first hearing, and the questions from the committee were in a couple of different categories. The first was regarding the confusion that might arise by combining gift certificate into the concept of gift card. And do we have the drafter here, Marit?
She should be online.
Okay, so she will be online to explain what her thoughts were, but I still fundamentally disagree and believe that we ought to have a definition of a gift certificate and a gift card based on what the committee discussion was, which is that I think the public still distinguishes between a gift certificate and a gift card. I think we kind of know what they both are. The next point that we talked about was whether we ought to go in perpetuity or not. I'm leaning that direction, and we can have some committee discussion about it, and Mark can explain to you some of the things that we've thought about, but that's the direction I'm leaning. And so, Mark, you want to talk about that?
The in perpetuity?
Yes.
Well, you know, I had another discussion, for the record, Mark Carlson Van Dort, Senator, staff for Senator McGuire. I had additional conversations with Rachel Lewis of the Department of Revenue about the in perpetuity, and I have come to the conclusion in my discussions with her and also with Senator McGuire that I think it truly does strike a nice balance between the consumer protection and also, you know, maintaining individual business owner discretion as to whether or not they want to issue gift cards or not. The committee picked up on the fact that the state of Alaska is making money off of this unclaimed property. And I think that we haven't found a real good reason to limit that. The value of the gift cards, you know, will remain the same. Rachel Lewis also brought up that we're not changing the unclaimed property law at all. We're just including gift cards under that. And that provides an avenue of recourse for the consumer in the event that, you know, a business owner declines to honor a gift card after such and such date. So as opposed to having to go through the Attorney General's office and getting this big, you know, kind of muddled mess, they can go straight to the Department of Revenue and click online and get the full value of their gift card back if it has been already reported as unclaimed property. And Senator McGuire and I also had a discussion. She brought up the scenario of what happens if, you know, somebody has a gift card for longer than, say, 7, you know, very long time, 10 years, and they bring it back to the business, and the business has not reported it as unclaimed property. You know, what happens then for that person, the holder of the gift card? And my understanding of the law, and this is also verified by the Department of Revenue, is that the person that has the gift card can either say, honor this, or I will report you to the Department of Revenue, in which case they have the ability to assess penalties and interest to the business owner for not reporting the unclaimed property within the amount of time, 3 years.
So the law in the books, just to be clear, we're not changing. You're required, unbelievably, I didn't know this, but as a business owner to report an aggregate of $750. Once you reach that mark of unclaimed property from your business, if you will, you have to report it. That's a requirement that was put into state law many, many years ago, and it still exists. So the bill does not change that. The only difference is it includes a gift card into that. So what we're anticipating or hoping is that businesses have a choice. Going back to the coat scenario, I go in to buy a coat for Senator French, or I decide at the last minute I'm not sure what color he likes, so instead I buy a $200 gift card for him that would allow him to choose between the red or the blue coat. And so either way, I've given that business $200 of my money, period. And so the business can choose at that point in time to calculate it for however they want into their profit statements. They can then later, if they decide, put it sort of off the books and 3 years later report it as unclaimed property. They can choose however they want, but if they have reached an aggregate of 750, they're required to report unclaimed property, which gives the consumer the ability to go online and get that money back. And I think that's a really nice consumer protection to have in Alaska. Because frankly, you know, I think about the elderly a lot. I think about myself a lot right after I had my baby. Just trying to remember, you know, we do that. And yet somebody has given their money toward that gift to you. And so it still ought to have a value. So I am, though, as you know, always open and willing to listen to any suggestions that the committee would have. This is kind of a nationwide movement. And again, as Senator Green pointed out, it would eliminate any fees or interest rates or anything associated with it. So once you give the two $100 bills to the merchant, that's what it is. It's $200. And the merchant has no obligation to issue gift cards, but we believe they will. They've been making a lot of money off of it, and we believe they'll continue to. So, Senator Green.
Okay, because I know the situation we ran into is we were in a totally different, it was either at Fred Meyer or Safeway or something, and there was a whole rack of cards from different vendors, you know, in different stores and everything. So either that card is discounted and the store receives a token for selling it, or the store has to sell, has to add on a fee for being the merchant that sells it. Now, is that fee also impacted?
My understanding of the bill is that unless it's a bank-issued, a federally issued gift card, that they would not be allowed to assess those fees.
Just a follow-up on Senator Green's question, because I hadn't thought about it until she mentioned it, but it's right. I mean, in cars now, they have Nordstrom $50 gift cards. So I just have to assume that somewhere between cars and Nordstrom, they've made an agreement that, you know, Nordstrom gets 48 of those dollars and cars gets one or some split like that. But
I don't see, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't see anywhere in the bill that it says they can't make those kinds of arrangements. The distinction is that you as a consumer aren't going to be required to pay more. So when you buy the $50 card at the checkout stand, you get $50 worth of merchandise. Now, what happens between Nordstrom and cars is not impacted by this bill.
Right. But I just want to get that on the record.
Yes.
That $50 is good for $50 at Nordstrom.
$50.
And if I want my money back, I can get all $50.
That's exactly right.
And do I get it back from cars or do I get it back from Nordstrom?
Nordstrom, at that point.
Yeah.
But I can guarantee you, if you were to go to the store today and try to buy a $100 or $150 gift card, you would be paying $6.50 or something onto that gift card. And that's their fee for their markup for selling it.
And they'll have to make that decision about whether or not they want to renegotiate. I would pro-offer that it's been extremely valuable for Nordstrom and others to have the availability of those gift cards, and probably worth it to strike some other agreement. Now, when I purchased one, I didn't have that. I remember, now this has been a few years ago, but I got somebody, maybe it was a Barnes & Noble or something card, but I got the full value. I paid $20, got the card. But what we're seeing and why the bill is necessary is that in an increasing trend toward adding on and tacking on fees, that the consumer, basically passing it on to the consumer.
And at every purchase.
At every purchase. And so, you know, there are these hidden fees and people don't know. They get the card and they assume, well, it says $50 on it. Mm-hmm. I assume that's no different than giving me the jacket. They go in and only to find out that, oh, a year has passed, so we've deducted this amount from it. Or to then be at the checkout counter and have a $6.50 extra charge ascertained. So, again, it's going to come down to business practices, and they'll have to decide whether or not those type of arrangements, the benefit outweigh the setbacks. I think they will. But
I might suggest that as we pass this on to Labor and Commerce, that we draw that to their attention. They may want to call in some people to testify on that to see how that impacts. Because it is convenient to be able to go to the store and pick up all these different gift cards.
Yeah.
And but we might want to.
Senator Stevens.
Well, I think it's right. It really is convenient, particularly for those of us who don't think about buying a gift until Mother's Day. And and if you mess this up, I'm going to blame you for this.
Okay. So why don't we, by Labor and Commerce, make sure that we reach out to Kars, is the one I'm thinking of. I think Kroger owns the Fred Meyers, and ask them to come in and talk about the structures that they've, and I know it's changed, so how it used to be, how it is now, those kind of arrangements. Okay? So any amendments that anybody wants to put forward? And then, Mara, how do we need to deal with the gift certificate definition?
The short answer, that the way that Teresa Bannister, the drafter of the bill, explained it to me yesterday afternoon, was that gift certificates are defined in statute under gift cards. And so we cannot add gift certificate in there because we would have two terms meaning the same thing in the bill. And that we would be required, in order to add gift certificates in there, we would be required to define gift certificates and redefine gift cards.
Is Ms. Bannister on the phone?
Yes, I'm
okay.
here.
Okay. Why don't you explain that to us briefly, and then tell us how the concern the committee had was that we kind of know what a gift certificate is, and we know what a gift card is, and we both see them as doing the same thing but different things.
Well, it could be the terminology that's a problem. I mean, if someone, you could use a different term, a more general term, a gift device, you know, that okay. people argue, or whatever, that would arguably cover in their minds certificates and cards and everything. But right now, a gift card, which people have a certain, apparently have a certain definition in mind, is the main definition, and it's used throughout. And if we were to just add gift certificate in addition to our gift card, as Mara explained it very well, we would have a separate term being used, but it's actually involved. Gift card covers it.
Why do you have gift certificate in the title?
Pardon?
Why did you choose to include gift certificate?
Well, there's one technical error in it, because we're affecting gift certificates. We're changing the names and all that, and that's why I was trying to be very careful to say, oh, we're talking about gift certificates, to the extent that we're kind of replacing the terminology with gift cards. So we wanted to notify everybody that we were addressing this. But in the page 1, line 5, actually it should be, the title of the section should be corrected to be gift card and credit memos. But that can be done by the reviser later, but that's a technical error that we would need to correct. But it's all, and the title is just to alert people that we are dealing with something, we're changing the relationship of gift certificates so that it's now covered by gift card. And that's all. Whenever we kind of delete something or change a term, we try to evaluate whether or not we need to alert people to tell them that this has been affected.
Okay, and so prior to this bill, in fact, what we had was a gift certificate, so
right.
we never had gift card defined, if you will. So what?
Not as such, no.
Okay, so now the question is whether you define them both separately, or whether you replace the term gift certificate with gift card, or whether we call it a gift device.
Or some, whatever, yes, something general that won't cause people to think it's one thing or the just one thing or the other.
Okay. Thoughts from the committee? Senator Bundy? What do you guys think? Senator Stevens.
Maybe she could explain a little bit about a credit memo and how that differs. And I assume that's where you take something back and get the, or that would not be a gift mm-hmm. device, though, would it? Because I'm going to say more.
Is that where you return something and then they give you a credit?
I think this is, I don't want to explain too much of this, but I had this bench press I stopped using for 20 years. And so my wife took it to this place here in Juneau, and it's called Played Against Sports or something like that. And so you get a credit memo, and it's not a gift. No one gave me the gift. I just stopped using it. So so how does that play into the whole thing, a credit memo? That's certainly not a gift, right?
I would have to check the comments of the Uniform Act that this was probably, I think this was taken from the Uniform Act, and see what they mean by credit memo. But we have not touched that. I would assume that that is something that doesn't fit up. It conceivably could be included under gift card, but I have not put it there because we did not, were not instructed to change that, but also because it seemed to be a different item totally.
So it's not impacted in this bill.
It's in the wording, though.
Yeah, it's not affected by this bill. We've left it as it is.
Senator Bundy.
This being proof of there's no simple issue that we can't convolute. At least in my experience, and I'm just going to go on a kind of a practical view here, we've all purchased or received a gift certificate, and I don't recall ever having those discounted.
Yeah.
So what your bill is focused on is the new phenomena of gift cards.
That's right.
And I would say that the gift certificate is a distinction that doesn't make a difference. And I encourage you to go ahead with the card,
okay,
which is the new electronic version that they're basically doing what we do with credit cards, and that a merchant has to take a 6% discount. And then I've seen some merchants say if you buy with a credit card, the price is 6% higher.
Yeah.
So it's obviously your bill, and you'd say what you want to do, but I think you've got 50% of something with the gift cards, and maybe that would be call that a victory and move on.
Yeah. I think my inclination is to keep it the way it is, but I think we should make the technical change. So I'd offer an amendment, page 1, line 5, to change gift certificates to gift cards rather than waiting for the drafters to clean up the mess. So that's amendment number 1. Is there an objection? Okay, hearing none, amendment number 1 carries. Further amendments or discussion on Senate Bill number 115? Okay, is there a motion? Senator French?
I would move that Senate Bill 115.
Oh, Senator Green, my apologies.
You know, the drafter said that, you know, with forgiveness from Senator Bundy, that this gift certificate is defined under gift card. And I'm sorry, I don't see where gift certificate is defined, or how you have any reference to it. But because anyone who's getting ready to do this provision, make a gift certificate or whatever, is going to read this and say, oh, this only applies to gift cards.
Ms. Bannister, do you want to?
Yes. The gift card is a broad definition. It means a device, any kind of device. Device could be a certificate, card, whatever, that it follows at meets the rest of the definition.
It's usable.
That's what I meant by it's defined under gift card. The gift card definition includes, by its terms, gift certificates.
Well, on that
note,
on that point, Ms. Bannister, I was agreeing with you when I read lines 29, 30, and 31 on page 3. It says a gift card means a device that's usable up to its face amount. I thought, okay, that could be a piece of paper that's usable up to its face amount. But then right above there on lines 26 and 27, we say a device includes an electronic card, but doesn't also go on to state that it can also be a handwritten, you know, piece of paper issued by a store.
Should say so.
You may want to do that. Includes is a term. If we said means, that would mean it was just an electronic card. Includes, and there's a definition in the statutes generally that applies. I mean, includes but is not limited to.
Yes, ma'am. I understand that. But the first thing you see is electronic card, and
that's gonna.
Right. You may want to add, if you want to add something that might be more recognizable by people as to what's going on.
Do you have any suggested language? Includes an electronic card, comma, and a paper certificate.
That would be fine.
And a certificate. I don't know that it has to be paper.
Certificate.
Okay.
Well, includes a certificate or an electronic card.
Card, comma, paper certificate.
Okay.
I want it to be before electronic card because I don't want any chance that electronic is modifying it.
Got it. Okay, so it would say includes a paper certificate, comma,
or
an electronic card.
Paper certificate or an electronic card, yes.
And a comma there.
No, I don't think you need a comma.
Senator Green disagrees.
No, I say you don't need a comma.
Okay, yeah, she agrees.
Advice includes a paper certificate or an electronic card, comma, but does not mean an access number.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Does that accomplish what we're trying to do here? I think it does. It makes it more clear. Now, the only other question is there any kind of material that you could put a certificate on that's not paper? While we're in the 21st century, I don't know.
Cardboard.
Should we just say certificate as opposed to paper? I'm just trying to think if there's any other kind of material. I had somebody come to my office the other day and give a business card made out of metal.
Oh, yeah.
I like those.
And I thought it was really neat. Yes, and we know who we're talking about, but never thought of it. So we would all think of a paper business card, but in fact it was a metal business card. So should we just say certificate?
I kind of like to add the word paper. It seems to indicate hand done.
It, if I can interject something here, I think that since we've used includes, that does not exclude a metal certificate.
Okay. All right. Thank you. So the amendment number two that I'll offer would be includes a paper certificate or an electronic card, comma. So that's amendment number two. Is there an objection to it? Okay, hearing none, amendment number two carries. Any further amendments or committee discussion I missed? Senator French.
I will again move that Senate Bill 115 be passed out of committee onto the next committee referral with the attached zero fiscal note.
And as amended.
As amended. Thank you.
Okay, any objection? I think we're all ready for this bill to move. One way or the other. Okay.
Where does it go next?
It goes to Labor and Commerce. And so we'll try to get some of the merchants into here. And for the telephone folks in the room, it does not include telephone cards. That's a whole nother subject. Terry Bannister, thank you very much for your service and your time today.
Thank you.
Okay. Next up, we have Senate Bill number 116 for its first hearing. And we have Senator Terrio. And just to make it clear, we're not going to move this bill today. This is just its first hearing.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. Senate Bill 16 is the sunset extension for the RCA. Before you today, you have the CNRA committee substitute that was passed by Senator Olson's committee. Initially, the bill asked for an 8-year sunset extension. That was the recommendation by our auditors. Having been the chairman of Budget and Audit, I like to, as much as possible, get the auditor's suggestions on the table for discussion, and certainly is our call as policymakers to change that. So my original bill did have the 8-year sunset extension that is the sort of the new default for sunset extensions. CNRA rolled it back to 6. As they rolled it back to 6, they put in a new mechanism that would ask the budget and audit or staff, the auditors, to do a 2-year sort of report card. It wouldn't be a full-fledged sunset audit review or full-fledged audit, but it would look at the statutory timelines that the RCA has and give us a report card. Are they meeting their timelines? How often do they ask for extensions? So we would have information more frequently than waiting for the sunset review. And so the CNRA language proposed that every 2 years that you would get that report card, and they rolled the 8-year sunset extension back from 8 to 6 years. And certainly if it's the will of this committee to keep that 2-year report card, whatever number that you set the sunset extension out to, you want to keep it to multiples of 2 so that 2-year report card fits into that. Now, there are a number of ideas that have come from the regulated community on suggested changes to RCA, additional timelines, change in their discovery mechanism, and it'd be my preference just to keep the sunset clean. I think the policy call that faces us right now is, shall we extend the RCA? Do we think that there is a place in state policy for an RCA? And I would pose to you that there is. Certainly, if we don't have the RCA, then all of these issues end up in the legislature's lap. And I don't think that we are staffed or equipped, or our timelines would accommodate us making these types of regulatory changes. So from my perspective, we do need to extend the RCA. The bill that's before you is that specific policy call. If so, how long? And keeps it to that very clean policy call. The other issues, I have been working with some of the regulated community on different ideas that they have floated Also, Ms. Geyer with the RCA Commission has suggested some language. It was my hope originally that the administration would support a separate package of changes to the way the RCA operates, but I think that with their plate being somewhat full with AGIA and other legislative issues, the indication is the administration is not at this time going to put in a piece of legislation. So what I'm doing is just trying to sort of boil down those different ideas and look for a majority sponsor or a committee chairman that might want to put it in. If I don't find one, I certainly would put something in under my own name for the body to consider. I think that it's my impression that there is a growing consensus amongst the regulated community that there are some sensible changes to make to the RCA's criteria as far as salaries for the the commissioners, whether there should be an executive director to take care of some of the administrative functions, some changes to the discovery, some additional statutory timelines. Seems like there's a growing consensus on that, and if the members of the regulated community don't get too greedy, I think a package can be put together that will have broad support, and I sense that there's a willingness to work on such a package. So I'm working on that separate from this bill. It's not to say that the legislature sometime along the line wouldn't want to add it to this bill, but I think certainly it's been my history that we try to keep the sunset extensions clean, especially when we know from the past that they can become so contentious. So with that, I think with the bill that's actually before you, again, is a 6-year sunset extension, a requirement of a 2-year report card that would be done by the audit shop, and it's just that clean policy call at this point.
Okay, questions for Senator Terrio. Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. So, Senator Terrio, so if we go to this 2-year report, I'm just trying to figure out what that really does. Is there an opportunity with a 2-year report card, not a full audit, that you could actually make or cause some changes to occur? Would that be appropriate in that type of after that report is given?
Certainly. Even though we put the sunset extension out 6 or 8 years, if the legislature gets information between now and then that the commission is not operating properly, you can introduce a bill any year to roll that sunset extension back to make it immediate. If there's a sense here in the body that the RCA has gone way off course. So I think what the 2-year report card calls for is that information be collected and given to the legislature so there's an indication whether things are going astray. Are they missing the timelines? Are they requesting extensions more often than we think they should? Are there the number of cases that get appealed to the courts? Are they going up? The number of times the courts overturn them, is that going up? I think that is useful information for the legislature to have between now and when the sunset comes up again, because there is such a possibility for things to get so contentious in the RCA because of the things that we charge them with to oversee, the dollars that are involved. Anytime that you've got somebody that in a quasi-judicial system that you're going to have winners or losers, there's that possibility. And what this report card gives us is just some clean information on how are things operating.
Follow-up, Senator Stevens?
Yes, thank you. And so you would see this as going just to budget and audit, or would the broader legislature have a chance to look at this?
No, it would be a report card that is done by the audit shop, but it would be then submitted to the legislature. And the legislative body then would decide whether things are running smoothly or whether there needs to be some intervention before the next sunset comes up.
I guess I'm just trying to figure out how it actually arrives at the legislature and who it goes through and who sees it. Would it go through a committee process, or how do you see that happening?
It would just be a report that's done by the audit shop. It's then presented to the bodies. The secretary reads it across. I would suspect, though, that if there's any segment or group in the regulated community that feels like things are off course, they would certainly bring that to our attention, too, or they would point your attention to a legislative report that has been entered in, into the body.
Senator French.
Thank you. This, one paragraph down, or actually the next two sections, sections 2 and 3, are repealers and reenactments. I'm just curious why it was necessary to do that instead of amending the statutes as they are, and maybe you can just summarize what changed between the old 4505211 and 4506220.
I think that just speaks about the commission's report, their annual report.
I mean, I agree. It seems pretty straightforward. I just don't know what's being lost.
Yeah, what's repealed?
From the old statute. And so, something had to fundamentally change, and I just don't know. I haven't.
I'm sorry, off the top of my head. I was focused on the other sections, and I'm sure that Ms. Geyer can answer that question, too.
Sure.
Okay, can you speak to that? Okay. And if you just put yourself on the record.
Yes. Madam Chair, my name is Kate Geyard, and I'm the chairman of the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. The repeal and the provision, there was language that changed the date. We used to report on February 15th, so our fiscal year ends on June 30th, say 2006, but you wouldn't get your annual report due date until February 15th. So that language came out, and November 15th, which is far more timely, and also gives audit a chance to take a look at it and report to you by January. And also there were there was language in there which required us to report to you on things that we actually don't do. So we fixed and we repealed that portion, or we asked that you repeal that portion. And the exact language required us to communicate to you, I think, on the status of the development of utilities, mm-hmm. or something like that, which we have never done, and so we just wanted to clean it up and clarify.
Let me, if you could just stay there for a minute, let me read into the record the exact statute that we're repealing so that members can decide whether there's a point they want to make there. So 4205211, as it stands now, on annual report, the commission shall, by February 15th of each year, publish an annual report reviewing its work and notifying the notify the legislature that the report is available. The report must contain information and data that bear a significant relationship to the development and regulation of public utility services in the state, and include an outline of the commission's program for the development and regulation of public utility services in the forthcoming year.
And Madam Chair, we don't develop the public utilities in the state of Alaska, and which is why we kept particular language out, because we've never actually obeyed that law in our annual report.
Okay. Does that answer your question, Senator French?
It does, but it just brings up one, I guess, one observation, and that is it seems to have a forward-looking aspect to it. You know, what are you going to do next year is what I heard about, you know, not so much development of utilities, but sort of what do you see coming in the future? And it certainly looks like that is being lost. I don't know whether that's important or not, but at least it's something we should consider. I don't know whether in the past you've even done that. It sounds like you've avoided the development of utilities because that's certainly outside your purview. But what about the sort of forward-looking aspect of the statute that we're repealing?
Madam Chair, Senator French, what we've done this year, which we haven't done before, is we've showed you the new cases that we filed in our annual report. Because the annual report isn't filed until February 15th, there's such a great amount of time that goes by. This year, we've given you cases that take place between the end of the fiscal year and June, and when we got it together.
Publication day.
So you will know in the annual report. We certainly do not mind if you require us to report that data, but we put it in here because the time was so different. We wanted you to know what's happening today.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Further questions of Senator Terrio? I think we're still
Thank you,
on. Ma'am. Further questions? Okay. All right. Then I'm going to go ahead and go to the folks that are here to testify. Actually, why don't we start with you, Chair Geyard? Okay. Okay. And Shalon is distributing the backup for what is going to be discussed here.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much. The Regulatory Commission of Alaska very greatly appreciates the Senate taking up reauthorization. It can be very challenging bill for you, and I think for the public utilities and pipeline carriers in the state of Alaska, and it's certainly never something that just goes smoothly, nor should it. We regulate approximately $1.5 billion worth of commerce that takes place in the state of Alaska. It is a substantial responsibility. Our decisions can impact one entity to the tune of millions and millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars sometimes. Our decisions can also impact the state of Alaska's economy. You recently heard that our decision on the TAPS pipeline case, and if the FERC follows the decisions of the RCA, $818 million a year have an impact on the royalty revenue of the state of Alaska. And so we should be held accountable. Our agency should be transparent. And you should ask us during these times and anytime you have questions, what's going on. It's an extraordinarily important role. And so we appreciate, you know, the time and attention that is required from you when you hear a complaint or a concern from the utilities. And we appreciate that you call us and ask us what's going on. We want and we advocate greater transparency, as much transparency as is possible outside of the adjudicatory process where we meet together to discuss a case. We also have been working with utilities for almost 3 years since I've been chair to bring the agency and make deep, sustainable change that's not based on the personality of one person, but is institutional change. And it takes longer, and it takes the help of you, and it takes our going out and listening to the utilities and being willing to be criticized and being willing to open our ears up to that criticism and say, okay, fair enough, ego's got a little dented, now what are we going to do to fix it? And that is hopefully, by and large, the attitude that you will hear when you talk to the public utilities and pipeline carriers in the state. They're not going to say we love all their decisions, and I don't expect them to. We impact their bottom line. What I hope they say, and what my goal would be for them to say, is that they're working to be better. They've worked in the last several years to be better, and the agency is coming out, and it's involving us in their processes more, and we can see improvement. And I think that that is, of all the things that were said in the audit report that was issued, the greatest thing that I took back from that was that the independent auditors did a poll without us controlling it, and 55% of the regulated utilities and pipeline carriers that responded, 55% said the RCA had somewhat improved or significantly or improved. So, you know, that's not 100%, it's not 80%, but we regulate them. I thought that was pretty good. So we're here before you with a 6-year provision. We're comfortable with 6 years. It's a bit challenging to go 4 years and to tie right closely to the election, a state election for a governor. It would be okay with me if you did 5 or 7 or 3, but it's a bit challenging for a new governor to come in and have the RCA sunset to address. It can be very challenging. So I'd seek whatever changes you want to make is fine. We put in the 2-year audits because we believe we should be held accountable for the transparency, and we're going to put it in our annual report, and we want it audited to make sure that you know what's going on. So those are the comments I have on the sunset.
Okay, and will you be available next Tuesday by phone?
Madam Chair, I actually was planning on being here next
Perfect.
Tuesday.
Okay, because we're going to continue on with our work here. There's a lot of information that's been put in front of the members that I'd like them to have the time to go through. And this is what Senator Turio was referring to as more of the substantive changes that both the commission and some of the utilities and other folks that have been coming around to talk to you about is. And so the decision that we'll be making, as I see it, is whether we will have a separate Senate State Affairs Committee bill that would incorporate some of these changes, or whether or not
changes in this document.
That's right.
Thank you.
or whether or not we would, in the interest of time, and with Senator Terrio's permission, we'll see, include them into the bill that is the sunset. And so that's kind of the decision that's out there. So I want to have time for members to go through, mm-hmm. to be able to formulate questions that are meaningful to you. So if you could be available mm-hmm. first up on Tuesday, I would appreciate that. Okay. So without further ado, then, are there questions from the committee right now? Senator Stevens.
This material we have in front of us, Madam Chair, does this address the issues of that Mr. Gerard brought up earlier, professionalism, salaries, and the executive director? Is that included in this material?
Yes.
Madam Chairman, Senator Stevens, the RCA provided you in the past with some, we went out to our public process in November to ask the public utilities and pipeline carriers what statutes would they like yeah. to change. We took a record on that is embodied in a record R0610. And on the front page of this document entitled Senate State Affairs Committee Sectional Analysis, I've given you so that you could give your staff the actual reference. That has all the public comment on what the utilities and pipeline carriers would like to see changed. We then went through a process of public hearing and then voted on some to bring forward to you. Not all, but some. What I have done, in the interest of time, when the governor's office said that they were unable to sponsor a second piece of legislation as they had originally intended, I spent the weekend combining what I think is reflective of what the public wanted with the legislation that's currently before you. And so this, and then I have worked on that and run it through, taken some of the information that's in House Bill 209, incorporated it, although I didn't include certain provisions. And I think that what we have here is fairly balanced. We address the timelines, and there's conversations we need to have about those. I'm really excited about shortening those timelines. And we address commissioner salaries, although I bring it down to a lower salary than what the House bill says, and I have rationale for that. And we have a bunch of significant changes. It's your call whether you want to combine them. I'm concerned about the time element that's involved here. So I'm happy to talk to anyone about these, and I do believe that they're a result of substantial public process. Yeah.
So the work I would ask members to do while they're working on a lot of other things would be to go through this. If you want to go back to the original R06-10, is that
yes,
right?
Ma'am.
And read that and distinguish between or delineate between what the public commented on and wasn't included. Those can be available for amendments and so forth. And then, as I said before, the decision would simply be whether or not we want to do our own State Affairs Committee bill or whether we want to incorporate it. Either way, I think the governor had thought or considered about doing it, didn't. There's a House version, so I think it's incumbent upon the Senate to come up with some kind of vehicle to address the public's concerns that are reflected in that record. So be thinking about what those concerns would be and what vehicle or methodology the committee would like to go forward with, okay? So that's the challenge. Thank you very much, Kate.
Thank you.
Okay, so next I'm going to go to George Gordon. And I think you're online. Mr. Gordon?
Yes, I am.
And if you could just state your name and your affiliation for the record.
My name is George Gordon. Until 2004, I was a president and the CEO of College Utilities Corporation and Golden Heart Utilities, which provide water and wastewater service to the Fairbanks community, about 8,500 customers, representing 50,000 people. I'm currently the Director of Regulatory Affairs for Utility Services of Alaska, which provides administrative and customer support for those two regulated utilities. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to give input on Senate Bill 16. I'll keep my remarks brief so that if you have questions, you can ask them. I'm in favor of extending the RCA. 6 years is fine. The two-year audit is a good provision. And I've spoken with other utilities, and I've spoken with Commission Chair Guyard recently, in fact, over the past number of weeks, and we agree on a number of issues. I'll briefly reiterate those, and we're close on most of them. I have four major points. One is I believe that it's necessary to reduce the statutory time allowed for rate cases from 15 months down to 9 months. 15 months is too long. I think it's important to limit discovery during regulatory matters, and I understand that the RCA is considering opening up a docket, a rulemaking docket, which would make some good rules to limit discovery. It can either be done through a rulemaking docket or through legislation, but discovery now is too open-ended and is not in the public interest. I also believe that the salary and thus the qualifications of the RCA need to be raised. I personally am in favor that they earn near what Superior Court judges earn. Their pay levels for what they're required to do is currently too low. And lastly, I think it might be advantageous to have a position within the commission staff as chief of staff or executive director or something like that to exercise some staff control and to act as a liaison with utilities so that there's someone utilities can go to other than commissioners, since dealing with commissioners is fraught with ex parte peril. Mm-hmm. If you have questions, I guess I don't really care whether the issues are addressed in the sunset bill or a separate bill. It would just be a difficulty if there were no separate bill.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Gordon, for your testimony. Questions for Mr. Gordon? And those 4 points are recurring themes that I've heard from the folks that have come to visit me. And are contained in this packet in front of you. So thank you very much. Okay, next, Dean Thompson. Mr. Thompson, if you could just state your name and your affiliation for the record, and then go ahead and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Dean Thompson. I am an attorney for the Alaska Power Association. The Alaska Power Association, as many of the committee members knows, is a trade association for electric utilities in the state of Alaska. APA currently has 39 member utilities who provide service throughout the state of Alaska. Our members include municipal utilities, electric cooperatives, as well as investor-owned utilities. And regarding Senate Bill 16, APA supports extending the termination date of the RCA. APA supports reauthorization of the APA. Certainly, while APA and its members don't always agree with the substantive decisions of the RCA, I'm not aware of any APA members who are opposed to reauthorization or who are opposed to continuation of the current commissioners and commission chair. The general perception in much of the industry is that the RCA has improved significantly over the past few years, particularly in terms of docket management and in terms of seeking input from the industry through rulemaking dockets, as well as input on things such as the docket management system that the RCA uses to manage its workload. And particularly my observation, having practiced in front of the former Alaska Public Utilities Commission as well as the RCA since it was created in 1999, is that there has been significant improvement at the RCA, and I believe that Chairman Guyard has done an excellent job in initiating and overseeing ambitious changes in the administration of the RCA that so far appear to be improving the efficiency and effectiveness of the RCA's operations. Certainly, APA's members each have particular areas where they would like to see further improvements, and Mr. Gordon touched on some of those that I think other members I have heard similar sentiments from. So certainly there are ways for further improvement to the process, but I believe overall there's been significant improvement, and reauthorization of the RCA is certainly in our members' interest and in the public interest. The thought of not reauthorizing the RCA or bringing a significant change to the RCA is something that affects continuity and that affects the predictability of regulation itself. And to the extent that regulated entities have to interact with the RCA, get approval for rate changes, et cetera, continuity and predictability are important. And I believe the industry has seen increased predictability over the recent past, and we would want that to continue. Regarding the term for the extension, the Alaska Power Association has not taken a formal position on whether it should be 6 years, 4 years, 8 years, et cetera. But I understand that APA does not oppose the current 6-year extension term with audits every two years, as is provided in the current committee substitute for Senate Bill 16. Regarding the other changes that were discussed by Chairman Guyard and Mr. Gordon, again, I think APA's members might support some of those changes and would like to see those changes, but frankly, APA just hasn't had the time to review them in great enough detail to offer any positions at this time. And that is the end of my comments.
Thank you very much, Dean. Good to hear your voice. And to the extent that it's possible, we would like to hear more detail from APA. And so we intend to have hearings on this bill next week. So if there was an opportunity to assess some of the views of your members and come back before this committee over the phone, that would be great.
Certainly, we will bring whatever language is at issue to our members and review it as quickly as possible.
Okay, I appreciate it. Okay, I don't have anybody else. Anybody else here in the audience that wishes to testify today? Anybody else online that I've overlooked on Senate Bill 16? Okay, hearing and seeing none, then we will go ahead and close public testimony just for today, reopen it for Tuesday, and set Senate Bill number 16 aside. And before I do, I just want to thank Chairman Guyard for her hard work. And what a difference a few years makes, just to see that you and your fellow commissioners would reach out in the form of public testimony and to receive those comments back and to listen and to try to incorporate them and to continue to move forward to make the RCA more effective, I just think is exactly what we want to see as a legislature. And I applaud you for doing that rather than resisting public comments and changes, that you're incorporating them, you're welcoming them, and moving forward. So thank you for your sincere hard work and dedication. Okay, so next we have, and thank you very much, Senator Terrio. Next we have Senate Bill number 33 by Senator Bundy. And Senator Bundy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You've heard this bill before, and we've had some extended discussion. There is an additional question, other than the basic policy call, as to whether use of DNA should be expanded, and that is, should the DNA sample be taken at the arrest of the individual, as fingerprints are, and which was my general view that we ought to have DNA mirror what is policy under the fingerprint policy that currently exists. Excuse me. Or should this DNA sample only be taken at when the person is charged? My preference is, and I believe the preference from public safety would be at arrest. There can be arguments made that, of course, people are arrested who are never charged. But I think in the majority of cases, people arrested and they do end up with a charge. That's right. And would just point out again the parallel with fingerprinting. People, yeah, when they're arrested, can be fingerprinted. We do have somebody from public safety here that would be available to discuss the issue or online,
yes,
I believe.
Yes, they are.
And so I guess I'm asking the committee to review the two options, whether the sample be taken at arrest or at the charging, and and then would ask the committee for their judgment as to whether we go forward with this bill.
Okay, so just to be clear, backslash E says that when a person is arrested, the DNA is taken, and backslash C, which is the new CS, is just simply before us. Let's go ahead and just leave them sitting here until we make a decision. And backslash C says that when they're charged. So that's the distinction, is between charged and arrested. We do have three folks online and one in the room. Why don't I go ahead and go to Kathy Forrest, who's in the room from the Division of Juvenile Justice first, and then I'll go to the three folks online from Public Safety.
Hi, good morning. My name is Karen Forrest, and I'm the Deputy Director with the Division of Juvenile Justice. And I just have a minor suggestion to offer to clarify the language of either version, depending on which version that you choose to look at. Existing law makes a distinction between DNA collection for persons and for that of minors. So in Section 1 of these bills, under B1, it's referring to a person convicted in the state of a crime. And B2 is referring to a minor 16 years of age or older. And so what I would suggest for either version, so if you're looking at the version where you add a person charged, under Section 2 on line 13, I would just offer that you would add the term "or minors" following the term "the persons." So it would read, "the person's or minor's DNA was included."
Okay.
And I would make the same offer of suggestion under line 17, where it would then read, "the person or minor."
Okay, and let's see. On backslash C, that's line 18 for me.
Yeah.
But I see what you mean.
Okay.
I think we all get it.
I don't have C. I actually have a work draft E.
That's okay.
Okay, and there would be three places in that
extra
bill.
We'll get you a backslash C. It's okay. It's just one line difference. We see what you mean. Okay, and then so for the version that would be on arrest, it's the same idea. It would be line 14 and then line 17.
And line 18.
There's person on 18.
You're right. Okay. Okay, let's just clarify this really quickly here. So actually, on backslash C, it's going to be on line 15, it's going to be on line 18, and on line 19.
This is all page 2?
This is all page 2, and this is backslash C.
18. A question, Madam Chair.
Okay, Senator Bundy.
Line 23, it refers to a person again. The person is now legally maybe a person and the person are different entities.
Line 23.
Where is that?
You're on E.
Backslash E, the arrest version.
Yeah.
It says the person arrested.
And we would not suggest putting it into that line.
Oh, okay.
Because Section B6 is referring to a person arrested, not a person or a minor arrested.
Okay. All right, so let's just really quickly, just for clarity, let's stick with backslash C for a minute. And so we're line 15, line 18, in line 19, to be clear?
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, that's the extent of the minor references. On backslash E, the recommendation would be on line 14, line 18, and not on line 23.
Correct, and it would also be on line 17.
And on line 17.
Point of order, can we have two?
No, this has nothing to do with the arrest.
Can we have two things before us? I mean, I know we're just sort of hopping over it, but
I think technically, Shalon, didn't we adopt version E? Yeah. So we technically have before us as a working document, we have version E, correct?
Yes. Last time you adopted C.
C. Okay. So we had C before us. And it is a bit unorthodox. I don't disagree. But in the interest of time, we have 15 minutes left. We will be working from C, but E is a version that is pro-offered by the sponsor just to be considered.
I understand.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, so next we're going to go to the three individuals from Public Safety. David Shade.
Yes, thank you. My name is David Shade. I'm the Division Director of Statewide Services in the Department of Public Safety, and the department would like to go on record as supporting this bill. As you know, it's DNA is required to be collected for those for persons convicted, and with this bill, DNA doesn't always get collected for persons convicted, or that collection gets delayed. One of the benefits of this bill will give the state another opportunity to and make sure that requirement is completed. That really concludes my testimony. I'll be here available for questions, but I also have the DNA CODIS manager with me, Ms. Michelle Collins, and my Records and Identification Bureau Chief, Kathy Monfrida, is also available to answer questions.
Okay, so questions for either Ms. Monfrida, Ms. Collins, or Mr. Shade? Senator Stevens.
Mr. Shade, the last person who spoke, I guess I'm not clear if you are supporting gathering DNA when the individual is arrested or when charged.
For the department, it is actually easier for us if this bill said arrested. We don't have a good mechanism to be notified or become aware of when a person is actually charged. We certainly know when there is a conviction, but at the time of arrest, we are also notified. So for the department, it does work better for us if the language was at arrest.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Shade.
Senator Bundy.
Madam Chair, on that point, and again, I'll defer to you with legal experience, but it appears that arrest is a physical activity. There's a law enforcement officer and the arrestee present, and fingerprinting takes place then. But charging a charging document can be, it's a paper transactions sort of thing, and the arrestee may not even be present when a charge is brought forward. That's my understanding, and if I'm incorrect, I'd appreciate knowing better.
I think more than anything, it's a policy call. Arrest is a point where somebody thinks you might have done something. Probable cause is there. The charge is a higher standard, and higher yet is conviction. So it's just a policy call to me. But I understand the point about convenience. Senator Stevens, and then Senator French.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I appreciate your taking the time, Mr. Shade, to explain this to those of us who were not in this legal field at all. But where someone were to be arrested and you take the DNA, then is that DNA shared so that we find out if that individual has been involved in other criminal activities in other states? Is that at the point which you share that information? Do I understand that correctly?
When we get the sample will be analyzed and will be put in the CODIS database. That information then becomes available if the DNA hits against a crime scene sample that's already in the database, then that information would be made available to law enforcement.
Well, thank you. And so it makes sense to me as a civilian here that that you find that out earlier rather than later. And thanks for your comments.
Madam Chair.
Senator Bundy.
Yeah, and maybe I'm treading on dangerous ground here, but I would use the analogy of, I think it was John Dillinger. They couldn't get him for murder, but they got him for income tax evasion. Somebody's arrested for shoplifting, and it's a while back in New York, they started arresting turnstile jumpers in the subway when they found out that people who were committing these petty crimes were often involved in larger crimes. So the opportunity of arrest, while it's kind of a broad net, it may serve to solve other crimes.
Okay, Senator French.
Well, I was with you until you brought up the income tax, because I'm thinking about doing mine, and I hope I don't have to submit any DNA with it. I lick the envelope, so I guess
You already gave it.
I guess that's
buccal swab.
I think you have to not give into, but the fact is that the physical arrest is the most efficient time to collect the sample. I guess I'm a little more philosophically comfortable with having some prosecutor review the charge to make sure it's a good charge before you actually grab someone's DA, but I see from this very helpful handout that most states are going with arrest, and I'm sure it's because of the physical proximity of the officer to the individual during the process of arrest. You can be charged and then arrested. More often you're arrested and then later charged. But there is no necessary connection between the charge and the physical presence of the human being. So on balance, if you like this idea, you've got to like arrest.
Okay, so I think what we need to do, it seems like the committee is going in the direction of arrest, then would be to have a motion to go ahead and adopt just for clean, as opposed to amending what we have before us in C, is a motion to go ahead and adopt a backslash E. So, Senator Green?
I move backslash E for CS for Senate Bill number 33 before us for consideration.
Okay, is there an objection to adopting that version? Okay, hearing none. Senator Bundy?
Just a comment, and I appreciate Senator French pointing out this information in your packet that staff gathered for us. Out of 34 states are considering expanding or beginning to use DNA as part of their crime-fighting thing. 19 of those 34 states are choosing arrest as the point of collection. And I know we don't care much how they do things outside, but we don't always have to reinvent the wheel either.
Fantastic. And for some later point, maybe in the next committee, I didn't have time, but I'd love to, in judiciary, just draft a real clear statement of intent that I think it's important that for those that would be wrongly arrested, a mistake was made in judgment. This happens. It does, believe it or not. That there's a very clear intent on the part of the legislature that information that was uploaded into CODIS be retrieved back. And I know that it's been put on the record that it would be. There's a severe penalty for misuse of it, but I don't think it hurts to really clarify and emphasize that that would be our intent. So I'll work on that before the next committee. So is there a motion? Senator Stevens.
Chairman, I move that we move CS for Senate Bill number 33 out of committee with the attached fiscal note and individual recommendations.
Did we make those changes? Back up.
They were certainly conceptual, and if we need to clean it up in the Judiciary Committee, it shouldn't be a problem. I heard them made to backslash E with respect to adding minor.
Let's go back.
Yeah,
do you mind putting your motion on hold? My apologies. So in version C, let's just go ahead and make the amendments so they're done.
Excuse me, Adam, it's version E is the one.
Pardon me, E.
And we did not amend it because we.
Okay, so let's go ahead and make the amendment. Senator Bundy's amendment would line 14 after persons add minors, line 17 and line 18, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So that's Senator Bundy's amendment. Is there an objection to it? Okay. Hearing none, then the bill is amended to include a reference to person and minor. So now we have version E before us amended, Senator Stevens.
So, Madam Chair, I move version E out of committee with attached fiscal note and individual recommendations.
Okay, any objection? And it's as amended. Any objection? Okay, hearing and seeing none, Senate Bill number 33 carries, and we're adjourned.